All right, everybody, welcome into another episode of Debate Night. Got a little three-man show. Well, I guess four, including myself today. We're going to talk a little bit about Cole Rodolin and the notorious bet that recently cashed. We're going to move into just some other topics about that tournament as well. Talk a little bit about Northwoods and such. But let's just hop right into it. We're joined today by Brody.
Yeah, I am in Cincinnati, and I tried noodles and chili.
Oh, like the Skyline chili?
No. See, I thought that was a Cincinnati thing too. I think that might be a Chicago thing. But no, we went to...
Definitely both.
Okay. I wasn't sure. I wish we would have gone there instead. We went to a place where they serve like literally like noodles, and then they put chili on top of noodles.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Skyline chili is a brand. I don't think it's a place. I might be wrong. Oh, it is a place?
No, okay. It's a restaurant. Skyline chili is a restaurant. Okay. But yeah, it's a crappy spaghetti and meatballs.
Okay. All right. And the verdict is out on that. Hunter the Robot joining us for maybe the last time as he almost threw his laptop out of the window today.
All the cards are stacked against me. I want to be very clear here. I have joined this freaking app we use to run this show and tour life from 17 different places, 4 different Wi-Fis, 3 different mics, and none of it works. I am not a technologically illiterate person. I just don't understand anything about this, and I think someone's out to get me. I think it's Dustin. I think Dustin has set this all up ever since I gave it to him in like that first one we went head-to-head, and I think he makes it where he wants me off the show. And I'm not going anywhere, Dustin. I'm going to freaking figure something out. I'm going to stream from a Motorola Razr if I have to, because that would be better than what's going on right now. But I'm
what
here.
What if you
and
were just audio? Like, what if we just gave you like a thumbnail photo?
I don't know anything. I'm willing to try anything.
We're going to turn Hunter into an Animoji next week. But then also, Caleb is joining us as well, returning to the show.
It's a pleasure to be back. Hunter, look, you got 6 extra seconds to enjoy that Chick-fil-A. So leave it be.
Well, he's not getting any this month. I guess my first month is supposed to go directly to Cole Rodolin, and Hunter so graciously has donated that. So, but that's what we're going to hop right into. We're going to start with the bet. First topic here. So obviously, if you haven't been following the channel, I made a rather notorious bet about Cole Rodolin after his first good finish at Waco. Hunter kind of quickly jumped in, was like, he's going to win this season. And I was like, all right, pump the brakes. You know, he just had one good finish. I said he wouldn't win this season. Obviously he just did. So now that he has won, and even though that he has won and I've lost the bet, did you see this coming from that early on? And would you have made the bet? And I guess if you're Hunter, how confident were you actually in the bet would be the way you could answer the question. Brody, what do you think?
First question is, what was the actual bet?
If he won an Elite Series or Major, I don't know if we just specified it couldn't be a silver. I guess silver wouldn't have counted. Okay, so silver would have counted?
No.
Or wouldn't have counted. So Elite Series or Major, okay. From that point on, whenever he won, I would have to once a month get Hunter Chick-fil-A. But if he didn't win for the season, Hunter would have to just get me Chick-fil-A one time. So I only had to make it to, October or whatever, and I was going to get Chick-fil-A. I was close, but I lost.
Yeah, no, I think that was actually a pretty decent bet. Like the odds of, because you're ending up having to get him Chick-fil-A for like what, 5 months, basically, something like that. So 5 months versus 1 month. Honestly, you probably got good odds there. I think the odds probably would have been a little bit higher, more in your favor, or should have been more in your favor. But you know, looking at his game, you know, you can look at guys on tour and you can see, do they have what it takes to actually win? And some guys right now, they don't. Like, even if they go out there and have their best performance, they would need a bunch of other people to really play poorly for them to win. Cole is not in that book. Cole's top game is good, is just as good, if not better, than the majority of people on tour. And I think that's what we saw this past weekend. I think we've seen blips and pieces of it with some of his top fives that he's gotten this season, of where he can go out and shoot really, really well. Now the question is, can he do that over the course of the entire tournament? And I think some people were expecting, you know, when he got into Northwood, things would be different kind of style of disc golf, clearly, but he was able to manage and actually able to even pull a bigger lead, leaving Northwood after round 3. So his game, watching his game, his backhand is so compact, so smooth. And then he's also really worked on his putt the last several years, because I remember playing with him not that long ago. It might have been last season or maybe two seasons ago. I played with him and he had one of the putts. He had one of those putts of where he was either making it from 40 or he was missing it and having another 40 footer. And that was definitely a part of his game that he needed to work on. He clearly has done that. He putts really well. And he is now just added to the list of people that you have to, you know, when they're in contention now, you have to be worried that they could take it down.
Yeah, certainly. I think he was actually an EV7 guy there for a little bit before he went to DGA. Hunter, what do you think? How are you feeling about your bet? And would you have done it again?
Well, on this side, of course I would have, but no, I was extremely confident when I made this bet. That's how we ended up here. Mainly because you see some players that pop onto the scene, and Cole had some previous success, nothing at a high level. He wasn't able to really get through that threshold and win. Obviously this was his first win that was above an A tier at any level in disc golf. But you can look at a player and kind of see their game and how they respond in certain clutch situations. And you could just tell back at Waco that he had all the skill in the world. It was just a little bit of a mental aspect of putting it together consistently. And when you have a player that young that has all that talent, and you could also tell he was kind of oozing confidence, it was just he was missing like one or two pieces. That was what led me to make that bet, because I've seen a lot of players that have a similar pop-off performance, and you can tell there's a big hole in their game. And it's like they had that performance because this course made sense for them. That's not what I saw at Waco. What I saw at Waco was someone with a complete game that I felt could go any course and compete. He seemed to have distance. He seemed to have really smart angle control and disc selection. And I felt like all that was really missing was just a little bit of the mental game, but he seemed to have really good composure. And that's what we saw this weekend, was he put it all together. And no, I was not surprised at all. I would make the bet 1,000 times over. I would have made the bet if I had to buy you Chick-fil-A every day for the rest of the year, because I knew Corey Dolan was going to win.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Ultra confidence from Hunter. Must be nice having already won
it's
the bet.
It's easy to say it on this side.
Yeah. Caleb, would you have made the bet if you were in my shoes? What did you think about it?
Well, I would have definitely made that bet. I think Cole Rodalin, again, to echo what Hunter and Brody both said, he's an extremely good player, and he's, you know, getting better year over year. 2021 was his first time on the Pro Tour, and since then, he's increased his average finish by 20 spots per year. I mean, he's really improving. He's got both a solid back and a good forehand, and you know, he's improving his putt. You look back from, gosh, Waco this year all the way up to, he got a third place there, third place at Preserve. He's improving solidly, and you know, I just would have taken that bet. You know, give me some Chick-fil-A.
He's young. He's young. He's definitely got a lot of potential. I will not make that bet next year, or maybe I will. I don't know. It was good press.
Run it back. Let's run it back.
It's good press. Cole Rodalin next V2. Year. I don't know. We might need to find another. Like maybe that's our thing now. Like in the first few weeks.
Well, Dixon scares me.
No, he's already been
it
around
does
the block.
Fit, though, robot chicken. I'm a robot. I make bets with chicken. You know, maybe all signs are pointing to Dickerson. Maybe it's time.
I'm just picking. I think Dickerson might be the highest ranked. No, Proctor. Proctor.
Proctor. Yeah, he would be a good one, but I would be scared about it. Like you gotta pick somebody early in the season that's like a young gun who like kind of flashes brilliance, and then like Hunter, just wait for Hunter to get super confident about it. But I'm also 0-1 with that strategy. So all right, so moving on, another kind of related topic here. So Cole Rodalin becomes the fourth MPO player to win their first Elite Series or major this season, joining Emerson, Parker Welk, and Corey Ellis. Are we seeing this trend more so because the bottom of the field has gotten stronger, or is it due to the top players not being what they were 2 to 3 years ago? You used to have to beat a very good Paul, Rick, Eagle, Calvin, and Dickerson, to name a few. It seems like we haven't seen that elite group of players at their best in some time due to injury and decline in play. Thoughts? Hunter, you can lead us off.
I think we're seeing a mix of both. I definitely think that you can... A few years ago, there was definitely a group of you have to beat like four or five guys. Now, I still think from this list, I think currently Calvin and Rick are the two right now. Paul, we've seen struggle. Eagle's hit or miss. When Eagle's on, though, you have to beat him a lot. And Chris Dickerson's nowhere to be found right now. But I also think that the field has gotten a lot better. And I think especially, it's not necessarily the bottom of the field. I think what is happening is players' ceilings are a lot better. Because what we see if we go back just a few years ago is Paul and Ricky could play okay and win because players' ceilings just weren't close to their players' ceilings were their average, and players aren't going to play at their ceiling consistently. What we're seeing now is a lot of players seem to have the same ceiling as Calvin, Rick, Paul. And what just happens is on a week where they're a little inconsistent, a player is able to push and play at that same level that they're capable of playing at. We're not seeing the consistency from the bottom of the field, but we're seeing a lot more players be able to play at that high level. And so I think that's kind of the mix we're seeing. I wouldn't say you can attribute it to one thing or the other, but personally, I think it's more so the field's gotten better than the top's gotten worse.
Yeah, very good point. Caleb, what do you think?
I definitely think that probably the bottom, but I'd say more of the middle of the field has just grown exponentially. That, and then when you mix the combination of Paul, Ricky, they are getting older. Once you get older, you start to deteriorate. You know, you age. Huh? My bad. But I mean, as you get older, I mean, injuries happen. You're more injury prone. And, you know, as we see with Eagle, sometimes you do something stupid and that doesn't pay off. But you know, used to it was that top five that you had to beat. Now it's that top 20. I mean, we go down the top 20. I think Ezra, according to StatMando, rounds out that top 20, and that's just a hard, you know, kind of top 20 to beat. Now it's 20 guys, not five guys. You have to beat every week to take a dub.
Yeah, definitely the middle of the field getting a lot stronger. I can definitely see that as well. Brody, what do you think about the field?
Well, I would even argue it's even more than 20 guys, right? Because you do have people that can pop off and have a great weekend, and they might not even be ranked in the top 20, but kind of like what Hunter was saying earlier about the ceiling. I think that's the big difference is not only do we have fields now that are full of touring players, we also have more players that weren't touring full time that now are and bump out a lot of, you know, half the field basically used to be not even half the field, like 75% of the field used to be just what, you know, they would call donators, people that have no chance of winning that are just basically donating to the pot. And that doesn't exist anymore. And I just wanted to look up now, obviously weather has a huge impact. And then also the course has a huge impact. And, you know, I would argue that right now Northwood Black is playing more difficult than Northwood Golds were. So just looking at that, right? Ledgestone this year, you had the top 10. To get in the top 10, you basically had to shoot 20 under or better to get in the top 10. Now, going back to a much easier course at Northwood Gold, right? Top 10, you had to shoot 20 under. Did I say that?
Yeah.
Sorry. Okay, so now going back just 3 years, we're just going back to 3 years to 2020. That was the first year I played at Ledgestone. Again, Ledgestone Gold, Northwood Gold, a lot easier, probably four strokes easier, maybe five strokes easier in Northwood Black. A 20 under would have gotten you third place. So yeah, right there just shows you the difference in the fact of, you know, not only what you were saying, Trevor, which I think is true, and I think when you have a field that isn't that great, if you are the best player and you go out and you play poorly and you win, no one knows really that you played that poorly. It's harder to see that, where now if a top player goes out and plays poorly, I mean, you can look at what Corey Ellis was doing before he DNF'd. You can look at what AB just did at this course. You can look at, Paul McBeth last year. I believe it was last year he struggled. You can look at certain times where top players struggle at a tournament and they're no longer getting fifth or sixth. They're now getting 30th, 40th, missing the cut. And I think that is a much better indicator that players are getting better. There's getting more players than the fact that the top players are getting worse. I don't actually think the top players are getting worse at all.
You don't think they're getting worse at all?
No, I don't. I don't. When I'm watching Ricky play, when I'm watching Eagle play, when I'm watching these guys, Chris Dickerson play, I'm not thinking like, holy cow, man, this guy used to never miss a putt. This guy used to never miss a gap. This guy used to never throw. No, it's just now that when they make mistakes, there are 10 guys that are passing them versus back in the day, there was one guy that was passing them.
Sure.
So instead of being fourth, they're now 14th. And that's, I think, what's actually happening. I don't think the top guys are actually getting worse. And you see that too, because the top guys, when they do play their best, which when they played their best back in the day, they would win. When they play their best now, they have contention. We saw Ricky. Ricky was in contention to win again.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, the whole effect of like being able to get buried easier, which is certainly alive, that plays a toll round to round as well. Because before, back in the day, those better players, they could go down one, two rounds and still know that they could come back. Whereas now, you might miss the cut. Like, you might just get completely buried. And that certainly has an effect on players. So kind of speaking into Northwoods a little bit, that's going to take us into our next topic. Because I would say Northwoods is one of the most talked about courses, one of the most polarizing courses on tour these days. It certainly gets a lot of press. So I'm asking just a very simple question. Is Northwoods Black a good or bad course for the tour? Why or why not? Caleb, what do you think?
I think Northwoods Black is a good course for the tour currently, especially for the viewers. I've never played Northwoods, so I can't take a player standpoint on it, but from a viewer standpoint, I think it's a great course. I know as a viewer, we love to see pros struggle. You know, that's something that's been talked about in the past. DDO last year, I know there was a lot of people that liked to watch that because it was, these guys are human. They struggle. They, you know, can have a bad hole. With that, I also believe it comes at a great time in the tour. You know, after really the month of June, we have, and even July, a lot of open bomber style courses. And when you go from that to a Northwoods Black, where it's more, you know, tighter fairways, it's more demanding shots. I think that's something that really the viewers appreciate more and more. I think what finally kind of did it over this year to make Northwoods be able to stay on tour and a good course on tour is they finally fixed the broadcasting issues at that course. That was a holdup forever. You know, when you can't see the front nine on live, you know, it makes it aware, why keep it there? I mean, De La Viega, I believe, it removed from tour because of broadcasting issues. You can't do that now with Northwoods Black. And I think that's why it's a great course on tour.
Yeah, the broadcasting was a huge fix. I hope they moved De La for more than just the broadcasting issues, as somebody who's now played it. So, hey, I've played it now. Yeah, Brady, what do you think about Northwoods? Because your boy Yuli loves it, just to throw that out there.
I will say De La's a fun... Yeah, no, I did see that. And I think I saw too where we're going to have Simon, I think, on Tour Life this week to talk about his chainsaw take.
Yeah.
But the first thing is it North? I think it's Northwood. I don't think there's an S. And
it might
there
be.
Might need, I think there might need to be an S because everyone says Northwoods and it sounds better. Northwoods Black.
Yeah.
We'll have to look into that.
Embrace debate.
It's always, I always love listening to what like your guys' takes are on courses because you guys are obviously taking it from the spectator side. You're taking it from what did it look like on the broadcast? How did it translate? Because I think it is a lot different when I'm watching the course and I've played the holes and I know exactly where it is you want to land, what gap you need to hit. And I'm always curious how that translates to someone that's never played the course. Like, does that actually work? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. A lot of that's also on the production, the camera angles, the commentators, all those things. But in regards to the play, I think they do need to fix a few things. I don't know how they did with backups on coverage on Northwood. If it was like, all right, we're going to go back to commercial. If that's what was happening, if where, you know, when we had a 45-minute backup on hole 12, I don't know how they handled that. But from a player standpoint, I think the rounds are far too long. I think when you're waiting more than you're actually playing, I think that's a bad thing. And so they definitely need to try to figure out a way of fixing that. And whether that is trying threesomes on that course, which would I think would make the pace of play an hour faster, that would be an interesting place to like, you know, try something new. But I don't really want to change too much of the actual course itself for pace of play because I actually really like the course the way it is. Maybe a couple trees here and there, take them out of the fairway, but I'm a huge fan of it. I like it. I think the one thing I would love for I always talk about like the change in ideas. Right now, everyone looks at Northwood Black and they're like, this is the hardest course on tour. I wish that wasn't like the case. I wish people were saying like, oh, it's going to be a challenging week this week. But I wish it wasn't, this is the hardest course. I wish this was like, instead of right now, it's at the very top of difficulty of courses. I wish it was more in the top like 30%, top 40%.
So you want to see more courses that are that difficult?
I think that course, that's one of the few courses we play all tour that actually will mentally break people.
Fair enough.
And yeah. If you look at the DNF thing on the FPO side and the NPO side, it's again, it's not the, hey, we're playing really too long of courses. Like we need to not play long courses. Players are getting injured. Because I'm actually going to look up how many people DNF'd at Portland Open, which is the longest course we play on tour, and see what that looks like compared to Northwood. But yeah, those are my takes on it. I think it's a great course.
Okay. Hunter, what do you think about Northwood? Do you think it's good, or Northwood, if that's what it is, do you think it's a good course or not?
Yeah, I think it's a good course for the tour. Let me go at it from a few different standpoints. One, I think one of the biggest qualms against it from a spectator point of view was that you couldn't watch it. They fixed that. Now, granted, it wasn't always great, but it was a heck of a lot better than not being able to watch. And honestly, it was better than I expected. I thought they did a good job of undersell, over deliver on it. They made it sound like, hey, guys, it might really suck out there. And to be honest with you, it kind of looked like their normal coverage at times. So I think they did a good job there of they mentally prepped everyone going in that it's not going to be great. So then when they were able to actually deliver an okay product, you didn't hear any complaining, or at least I didn't hear any complaining. So I think that was a really good thing that they did there. On the player side, I think what Northwoods does really, really well is it provides scoring separation that we are always hungry for. This course chews people up and spits them out, and I love that. And it does it in a way that, like Brody said, it breaks people mentally. It makes you really have to think about the shots, think about the disselection. It's not a typical woodsy golf where you see a line and you know what you have to do and you just have to execute that shot, and it's kind of a brain-dead way to play. That's not Northwoods. Now, where it falls is on the pace of play and the flow. We're obviously going to address that here on the next question with the backups and everything. But if we just look at the course and we look at what it creates for the event and what it creates for the tour, I think it's a phenomenal course. I think it has a place on tour. It's not a perfect course. I think there's some things we can address with it. But I do think it's a great, great course. And it seems like they're also making an effort to make it better to watch in person, which has been a previous struggle for it as well, which it is with every wooded course. But I think they're doing a lot of good. And one of the best things it does is it does mentally breakable and causes that massive stroke swings that we love to see.
Yeah, certainly the effect that it has on the field. Brody, do you have your stat?
Yeah, I have my stat. Okay, so if I told you that at Portland Open, there were 3 DNFs on the NPO side and 0 DNFs on the FPO side,
I believe how many? I think Northwoods had
Portland. Sorry. At Portland, there were 3 DNFs on NPO, 0 DNFs on FPO. How many do you think there were at Ledgestone?
It was like 5 and 4, wasn't it? Something like that.
There was more? 4 on the FPO side. There were 10 DNFs on the NPO side.
If you saw, and it could have been more, you saw Parker Welk's ankle.
It should have been. Parker yeah. Parker was, I mean, again.
That was a bad injury, yeah.
I don't know if, are we talking DNFs this show or no?
We're not talking DNFs.
Okay. I'll leave that for a later podcast. Yeah. I have a rant.
Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe that'll be a tiebreaker or something.
Show me the doctor. Hey,
you can say what you want about me being a robot, but we got Silhouette Brody this week.
I mean, he's a little darker.
I think the jokes take 15 seconds to land. That's really depressing. What? I send a joke out into the world. And I'm like, come on, someone laugh. And like 10 seconds later, I get a chuckle out of Caleb. And I'm like, all right, it hit.
Yeah, well, it'll play eventually.
Here we go again.
Yep. All right. So we got one more topic here. We're going to continue talking about Northwoods a little bit before we get into our elimination. And we're going to talk a little about hole 12. Obviously, some of you alluded to that hole. In my opinion, and I think in most opinion, that's the biggest flaw remaining with the course, to where we were having 45-minute backups. So my question is, are the long backups on hole 12 actually a solvable issue? If so, how can it be fixed? And if not, if they cannot solve them to something decent, should the hole or the course be changed completely? Brody, what do you think now that you are in more lighting?
Okay. So this is what I'll say, because I was one of the people that probably caused some additional backup, because it took me 8 shots to get into circle one on that hole. Okay, Hunter, easy. Jeez. Saw my tournament just flash right before my eyes.
I texted
on
Trevor and I
hole.
Said, Brody's about to get wrecked by this backup.
He did. He called it.
I knew it was coming. I was so depressed.
No, it was not the backup that wrecked me. It was, I won't go into it, but it was my own fault. This is what I'll say on the whole. Going into threesomes, I think is huge. I think that would help a lot, because that eliminates one person that can have a terrible hole, and that eliminates that kind of risk. The other thing I would say is, the way that the hole currently is set up, the only thing I would maybe adjust would be, again, this would make the hole easier, but I guess, I don't know. See, this is where it's tricky, because it's like, I don't know how easy you want to make it, but if you get on the left side of the fairway off of the tee shot, you have literally nothing the entire way. You have little 3-foot gaps that you need to hit, just the way that the trees are over there. So what ends up happening is, like, you know, if you get through those 3-foot gaps, great. Then you can throw your next shot over the water or over the creek, and then you're in the grass, and then you're moving. The backups are always because of people taking forever to actually be able to throw a shot over into the green area. And so, like, if you are trying to remove the backups, the other thing that you could try to do, and again, I don't know how great this would be, but you could essentially, and this is a crazy idea I just got thought of, you could take out a lot of trees on the left-hand side and create hazard. So then you kind of penalize people for not being on the fairway, but then you also just move the pace of play up a little bit. So you, like, take a penalty stroke and you move. I don't know if people love that. I hate that idea. But, like, that's, I mean, it took me like 5 shots to get across the, so I played a par 5 in the 300 feet of, you know, the first landing zone area. So that's why it's going to take forever, because then I have to play another par 4 that's long after that. So
yeah,
that would be my take on it.
No, that's a good idea. I actually like that. I like, you know, clearing it out to where it's, people aren't going to be there forever, but it's a hazard. So it still punishes. That's pretty solid. Hunter, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually gave my opinion on this on Grip Block, but I'll just kind of reiterate it, because I'm curious to hear Brody's take on it. Because I've played hole 12, so I was exactly where Brody just described. I was on the left, and it sucks over there. Also, the right kind of sucks. So I think a way to keep the essence of the hole a little bit, it will maybe make it a little easier per se, but I think you have to sacrifice the difficulty of the hole for the pace of play of the round at some point. That question has to be answered. So my suggestion is, put a Mando on one of the trees on the left, forcing you right, so you have to hit the gap. And that way, if you miss the gap, you have the stroke penalty, and the drop zone isn't progressing you way forward in the gap. You're still, like, at the gap, but you at least have a shot. So it's the same as, basically, it's almost simulating someone getting into there and just pitching sideways. And then I would make the right side, that initial right stuff, OB, the initial trees and stuff over there. Again, you won't take 2 or 3 shots to get back to the fairway, but it costs a stroke, but it's that pace of play. It makes it way faster, because there's not decision-making having to happen. And then I'd probably leave the rest of the hole the same. Originally, I was talking about up by the basket, but realistically, once you get up there, there are a lot of decisions making, but you don't want to take all of that out of the hole. I think that's what makes it a good hole. So I think if you solve by the tee, then it should solve a lot of the pace of play problems. And plus, what the Mando does is it still allows for a shot that left stuff farther down the fairway. It just fixes the initial, like, early release problems. And that way, if you get into it farther down the fairway, you can still scramble from there without a penalty other than just being in those trees. But it doesn't penalize that. So I'd probably put it, you know, a little bit down, Mando on the left, forcing you to hit that gap, and then you're penalized if you don't.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I like the idea of adding in some of that OB. Caleb, what do you think? Do you think it's fixable, or are we just removing hole 12?
I think it's definitely fixable. I think probably the toughest thing, Brody and Hunter both hit on it, is the tee shot on hole 12. Looking at that tee, specifically the tee box, it's at such a hard angle of attack to hit your line to get in the center of the fairway. It's so easy to yank it over, go over to the right, or, you know, put a little bit too much hyzer, or, you know, it hit up to the left and you're in the crap. So again, I think it's something to where if you change the angle of the tee, that could be a really simple way to open that hole up a little bit. You're not changing the hole, you're not changing the landscape, just opening up that angle of attack. I think that would be probably one of the easiest ways to do it. Something else, I think if you did a cut after round two and that allowed you to get into more threesomes quicker, that would as well speed up pace of play. Those are really just two simple things you can do to kind of get this hole moving. I mean, it's a great idea of a hole, but when you have a hole that's averaging well over a stroke over par, you got to start asking questions. Why is it playing this tough? Why, you know, what's causing not just the toughness of the hole, but also the time of the hole?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think, and you kind of mentioned, Caleb, you gotta eventually start asking questions. I think the biggest thing with this hole is, as long as they make an attempt to change things, you know, next year, then that's one thing. But it's when they just don't make any changes and they seemingly accept that the 45-minute backups are okay, that's when it's like, okay, well, what are we doing now at that point?
Like the Idlewild tee pads.
Yeah. It's definitely going to be interesting to see how they attack it. I think adding some OB or some hazard would be a big step in the right direction. Okay, we are going to hop into our elimination round. Unfortunately, Caleb falling 1 point short today. Hunter does have the lead, though, heading into the round. He may be able to end the reign of terror, and Brody is sitting down, so that's something to mention as well. So let's hop into our rapid-fire round. All right, we got three kind of random topics here, some that I just kind of pulled out today. Two are slightly related to the previous tournament, one not really. So first off, Hunter, since you are in the lead, would you like to go first or second?
I'd like to go first.
You would like to go first. Okay, the first question today, I think, you know, after the Colbert Allen bet hit, I kind of thought to myself, well, you know, that's crazy. But I was like, you know what? There are other players that haven't won this year that's a lot more surprising to me than Colbert Allen. So that's why I want to ask the question, which player, MPO or FPO, are you most surprised to see winless this far into the season, Hunter?
Yeah, I have to go with the obvious one here. Probably the reason this question was written, which is Sir Chris Dickerson. Now, obviously, I think 2021, he kind of stepped into it, into this elite class of players. Last year, he probably wouldn't have stayed in that had it not been for his win at Champions Cup, but he was still able to pick up two Silver Series wins last year, and one of them being an event that he basically owned, the Music City Open, also the Open at Belton last year. And I also want to just point out an A tier he basically always wins, which is Tennessee State. Coming into this year, he can't win Music City Open. He doesn't win Champions Cup. And this guy even got dethroned at Tennessee States. Also, last year, we saw a decent performance that he probably should have won at GMC. If you remember, he gave up all his momentum with that layup. I'll never give that one up. But this season, I really expected him to come into this year and be in contention a lot more than he has been. He's literally only been in contention. I'm going to look back at this. I think he's been in contention once, if you ignore the eights here that is Tennessee States. He's been in contention once, which was Music City Open this year when he came in third. And again, that's an event that he historically dominated. He couldn't even win there. And other than that, his name hasn't even really been mentioned other than where the heck is this guy? So there's some other players that I think you can make a case for, but the one that reigns true overall is Chris Dickerson. And he's got some good tournaments coming up to turn it around, but he better find one.
Yeah, certainly one that has he's been missing from that elite field that we're used to seeing him in. Brody, what do you think? Who surprised you the most?
Yeah, this week I probably wouldn't have deferred because I think this question, there really was just one good answer. And I think obviously Hunter did it. So I'm left with, I'm going to give you two then, because I think Chris Dickerson is the right answer here. So I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give you an MPO player and an FPO player. On the MPO side, I'm going to say James Proctor. I think we have seen his skill. We have seen his skill set. He's one of the best putters on tour. He's put himself in position multiple tournaments now to win. He just hasn't gotten over the hump, hasn't been able to put it together, hasn't been able to actually win when it counts at the end. So he's someone that I'm still waiting And again, that might be the future Chick-fil-A bet for next year. The other person on the FPO side, I'm going to go with Hall and Hanley. I think going into this season, a lot of people were expecting big things from her. And I think she's honestly has proven those people right. She has played really well this season. However, she, again, hasn't been able to actually win. She's put herself in probably more times than not chances to win, and she's just never able to capitalize. I think, too, with Kristen Zatar not being in the field, Paige Pierce not being... I got like an almond stuck in my throat. Paige Pierce, Kristen Zatar, I think them not being in the field, I think that opens the door for her to win. And hopefully she can get one before the season ends.
Hey, yeah, no, those are good answers. I think there's two ways to attack that question, right? You have like the person who surprises you because of what they've already accomplished. And then you have Proctor and Hall and Hanley who surprise you because they've been in contention and in the mix so much this year. It just seems like a matter of time. So definitely some good answers there. All right. So we'll go to you for this one first, Brody. As we creep towards the end of the season, we start thinking about free agency. Which company do you think is most in need of a big signing this offseason to stay relevant and kind of still have a good flagship team in front of them?
All right. Well, let's just kind of go through it, right? I think Discraft is obviously fine. I think Innova is fine. I think MVP is fine. I think Dynamic Dis, for the most part, with Ricky, I think they're okay. And I think Dismania, if they retain Eagle, I think they're going to be fine as well. So what does that leave us with? That leaves us with like Trilogy. That leaves us with Westside. That leaves us with Latitude. That leaves us with Lone Star.
Prodigy.
I think it's Prodigy. Yeah. I think you just gave me the answer. I think it's Prodigy. I think them, if Gannon leaves, I think they got to sign someone big. Or they got to like throw a crap ton of money at Isaac, like do like a big, huge re-signing with Isaac and make him the man or something. They need... That's the answer.
I mean, if Gannon leaves, they certainly do have to do something.
They need something big.
But they do have other players as well. You know, they have Alden and Ezra and Isaac.
Yeah, but I would say they have a bunch of they don't have the, again, like those, I think all those top players, like I think Isaac, Alden, Ezra, I think all of them are really, really solid players, but I don't think they're at the level as far as notoriety goes as a Ricky, a Paul Macbeth, a Calvin Heimberg, like a Simon Lizotte, an Eagle. Yeah. Like each company, it seems like, has one of those like top guys. And again, I think Isaac could fit that bill. I think he could fall into that. But as of right now, I don't think he's there just from a long-term standpoint.
Well, no doubt Gannon is their guy right now. Hunter, yes. Who do you think needs that signing?
Well, first off, I want to push back on the Prodigy one. I think that's a complete wrong answer. It looks like they're putting all their eggs into the Isaac Robinson basket currently. If you look at the UDisc live banner ad they're constantly running, you see the FX4, the choice of Isaac Robinson with the Champions Cup trophy in there. You also see they just dropped the Archive Midrange, which is a part of Isaac Robinson's signature series. Gannon Burr's yet to get a signature series. Kevin Jones is also a player that has been left off. Sure, he's not playing well, but the dude's still marketable. He's still electric. DJ KJ. You also have Ezra Robinson that's popping off, and he's performing very well. You have Alden Harris with the vlog. DJ, that's an invaluable asset. You know, I would argue that some of these players are more marketable than Gannon Burr, and I think they're going to keep all of them. So I don't think Prodigy's in need of a big signing at all. I actually think they're in one of the best spots for future-proofing their team, because we're not even talking about Caroline Henderson. We're not even talking about the European market with Vino Makalai. I think Prodigy's a bad answer. I think this
You just pick someone that's not even on tour.
Mainly because you have a lot of question marks surrounding Eagle McMahon. With who? Vino Makala?
No,
have you
Caroline.
Seen Prodigy's
Caroline's
dominance in Europe? You look
anymore.
At Power Grip Europe, the number one Europe.
No, I didn't know. No.
But the Caroline
delay,
Henderson
delay,
was still
the delay. The delay.
Delay kills me. Anyways, I'm going with who I believe needs the biggest signing the most, which is Discmania. And that can be the re-signing of Eagle McMahon. That could be the addition of Gannon Burr. But the problem with Discmania is they're a one-headed horse right now. They used to have two. They had Simon. They had Eagle. If they lose Eagle, which is a possibility, we've heard rumors previously of Eagle almost leaving, and by a stroke of luck, we'll call it, he stays with
Casey White.
If he leaves them, then they're literally left with Kyle Klein, who is up and down. I've said what I said. They're left with Kyle Klein, who is up and down. Anyways, Eagle McMahon, I think he's a crucial re-signing for them, but I think they really need an additional one to burst in. I think Prodigy's set. I think that was a bad answer.
No, I think, yeah, I think Prodigy does have a pretty good team. But I think also,
you said a player that wasn't even on tour.
Well, that was an accessory to the point. But, you know, Gavin Babcock, though.
Yeah, also Gavin Babcock getting no love, Casey White getting no love.
No, Discmania is certainly, if you compare Prodigy and Discmania.
I gave love to players that deserve the love.
If you compare Prodigy and Discmania from a certain standpoint of, like, they both have, if you even were going to say Prodigy has just Ganon and it was just Eagle.
Time out. Take those points away. Isn't Nicolas Antilla sponsored by Discmania?
Yeah, and so is Vino Makala sponsored by Prodigy, 1-1.
What is your point?
Prodigy dominates the European market. You're just completely ignoring them. Prodigy is by far the best seller in the European market, and that's not just by stroke of luck. Seppo Paiu is a freaking god over there, and he's running Prodigy Europe.
Your Discmania pick was terrible too, though. You're like coming on me like saying
Discmania is the pick. There is no other pick. Dynamic set, Latitude set, Westside, just like Nicholas a little side project. They both have
popular European players.
So is Vino Makala. So is Seppo Paiu. They're both on Prodigy.
Okay, so we're basically picking the same thing then. That we're agreeing that we both have the same thing.
No, Prodigy has more depth.
And then we have to go to the American market where Prodigy destroys them.
Yeah, I think Prodigy has more depth there. I mean, Discmania, they're in an okay spot. But if
should I have gone Lone Star? Is that what the answer I should have gone with?
I don't know. You could. You could.
I think Discmania is a bad answer too. Okay, so Prodigy is a bad answer. I think Discmania is a bad answer by a little bit less.
Okay,
both bad answers. I'm here just to beat you. As long as a little less.
Okay.
Well, the comments will beat us both.
Yeah. On to the last. Yeah. Let us know in the comments who you think needs a signing the most. I don't really know.
Probably Mint.
Mint Discs is another good answer.
Yeah. Good Mint Discs if they want to really emerge. Throw the grackle. Okay. So last topic here. It's a real disc and it's good. At what point is a disc golf obstacle too gimmicky? So we were talking about this a little bit on Grip Lock because, you know, using Eureka Temp as an example, most would say that the baseball field doesn't look good. Like that's gimmicky. But the bridge and the water tower, you know, kind of like they almost kind of fit in a little bit. Like they're gimmicky, but they look right. So my question is, where is the line and what are some examples of things that like they do work or don't work? Let's just try and figure this out together. Honestly, Hunter, you're first up.
Well, I think if we just look at the three examples you gave, the one that sticks out is something that just doesn't seem like it belongs on a disc golf course because it's for another sport. That's really the line there, because the other two, like the bridge and the water tower, are both used effectively. And honestly, the baseball field is too, but the bridge and the water tower are both used effectively in the course design. But the key is they fit in the setting they're in. And I think that's the line. I think if something looks somewhat natural, obviously a water tower doesn't look natural, but it fits that setting. So does the bridge. A bridge obviously is not natural, but it fits the setting. If things fit the optics of the area you're in and they fit the optics of the course and they don't make you be like, now, wait a minute, we're just throwing over a baseball field. We're in just a regular park. I think that's the line, is when something distracts you and pulls you out of being immersed in the disc golf round, that's when something's too gimmicky. And I think that's why the baseball field does that, but a bridge and a water tower don't.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it, honestly. You're completely right. I think that like the baseball field, it takes you out of that course immersion, whereas some other things can kind of keep you in. Brody, what do you think about the course obstacles?
Yeah, you know, you look at we're talking about hole five right now at Lake Eureka. And if you remove the baseball field completely and instead of the fence in the outfield, you just put hay bales and had them 4 feet high, like the fences, or actually the fence might be 5 or 6 feet high. So you have that hay bales all around. All of a sudden, you've got yourself like a really sick hole. And people are going to be like, holy cow, this hole's really freaking hard. So I agree. I think if you're using something outside of disc golf, especially if it's for another sport, I think that's when it's really bad, is if we have like basketball courts around us, or we're throwing over tennis courts, or we're, you know, having to throw a disc through a hockey goal as a triple man. Like when you start doing like weird stuff with other sports, I think that's when it looks really, really bad. The water tower one, the bridge is a no-brainer. Like that is a thing that we have to walk across.
Yeah.
So that's a no-brainer, as you know, bridges I think are completely fine. But the water tower one's an interesting one to me, because I think that's where it's like kind of right on the line of it is weird that we're throwing shots and some of them are hitting the water tower, and some like the bank shots and stuff off the water tower are very random. Sometimes you're going to get lucky and sometimes you're not. So it's like, throw a good shot so you don't have to get lucky. But the water tower, I think, is like right on the gray area. And yeah. I wonder if Ledgestone wasn't around as long as it has been, if we went somewhere different and it's a brand new course and they had like something similar to a water tower, take away the water tower and insert some other form of thing. I wonder if that would be the same. Cause like, to me, like European Open, one of the reasons that hole 18 is such a hard tee shot is you have like four light poles down the left-hand side.
Yeah.
And like, to me, I think that looks stupid.
Yeah.
No, it makes the hole harder, but I think it looks dumb.
It's a weird one. I agree. I think the water tower is like very close to the line. I'm curious, Brody, somebody apparently like was, I think Hunter was telling me somebody justified the baseball field hole because they said that the Raiders used to have to play on a baseball field and nobody was complaining about that or something. What did they say?
Hunter? Oh, like a multi-purpose field. Yeah. Where they put, yeah. There's a lot of, that's because the city doesn't want to spend a stupid amount of money for two stadiums. But the thing is like when you play football and it, the only thing you see is like the coloration of the grass is a little bit different, but it doesn't change the game at all.
Yeah.
And I would say it does look worse. I will say like people do complain, and right. I will say all the Raider fans probably were pissed off that they couldn't have their own stadium. So well,
that was my whole thing. I was like, well, we shouldn't justify bad ideas with other bad ideas. And guess what happened to that team? They moved to Vegas and built a giant stadium.
Yeah. Trust me. The NFL teams are pissed when they have to share their stadium with other people. And, no one's happy about it. No, like NFL teams out there like, well, hey, what if we, here's a good idea. What if we like had the baseball team come in and play at our same, no one's doing that. Everyone wants their own stuff. So,
yeah, I do think, I think it's interesting because I think Eureka Temp does like with the bridge, especially that's like a perfect example of like some things that can be kind of an obstacle, but still work seamlessly with the course. But in any case, Hunter is our winner today. The Last Dance episode, you could call it the flu game or maybe the virus game, like the internet virus game. Anything to say, Hunter?
It feels like a little bit of a fake win since I didn't beat Standing Brody, but I'm just happy that I was able to pull it off.
Yeah. I'm going to go out and let me say,
freeze completely.
No. We always hear you. I just like, and most of the show, your audio comes in clear, but I think my favorite debate night clip in history is going to be when I introduce you to the show as the robot. And the first word you say came in like a little robot-y. That was basically the funniest thing that ever happened. I thought I was going to cry.
I'm glad I'm here just for everyone's laughing enjoyment.
Yeah. Well, hey, you got the win today. Hopefully everybody enjoyed this episode of Debate Night and Robot Hunter. Comment down below, #justiceforrobots. And we'll see you in the next one.